Hello, hello.
What up?
Back
Look at you,
in the
mountain man,
States,
with your flannel.
the US of A. How are you guys doing?
Good, good. Travis is still connecting here. I've never seen you wear flannel before. It's a whole new look for you.
It's the Christmas flannel.
I am not judging. My closet is literally half flannel. I never got out of, Seattle 1992. So like I still have docks and flannel. So, I still have flannels that are dedicated solely to being tied around my waist while I wear other shirts.
Did you ever do the top button and hang it down the cholo style?
I never did the cholo style. That was I'm too white to do the cholo style.
Used to make fun of it, but secretly wanted to do it. I was like, oh yeah, you guys, that's so lame. It looks awesome.
No, I always did the I very much did the Eddie Vedder like shorts, docks, and flannel tied around my waist with a t-shirt on. Basically his entire look from the Even Flow video. So
Yeah, great look.
I
I could never
agree.
do the docks. They're just not that comfortable.
Oh,
I'm such a wimp.
I think they're so comfortable. They're like my
Well,
second.
compared to like dress shoes, you're a lawyer. You have to wear like actual bad shoes all the
Oh hell no, dude.
time,
I wear Blundstones. Like that's I wear
Oh,
like
okay.
the best shoes in the world for work every day. Yeah, I got over that like wearing uncomfortable dress shoes 20 years ago. I'm like, fuck it, I'm wearing Blunnies and I'm gonna just continue to wear Blunnies. And if people don't think they go well with the suit, A, they're wrong. They look amazing with a suit, and B, I don't care because my feet are comfy. So
I don't know what a bloodstone is. Is that it's a rubber-soled dress shoe?
yeah, no, it's actually an Australian work boot that kind of looks basically, well, Travis will know what they are. It's an Australian work boot that's incredibly comfortable. I have like
Okay.
seven pairs.
What are you wearing? Like Blunnies? You wearing
Yeah, we're
Blunnies?
talking about Blunnies. Yep.
I'm at Blunnies. Holy shit. Hey,
Yep.
boys.
Hey, Travis, what's up, buddy? How are you,
Hey.
man?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm really happy to be. I'm a little hungover, a little low key hungover. Had a big one at the pub last night and left my phone there. But I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right.
Right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this week's episode of Action for Everyone for this year, December 18th, 2022. We are recording a little bit later today than we normally do because, well, that's what happens when there's things like international time zones. But before we get to our guest, I am, as always, your host, Mike Scott. I have been quarantined for a week, but I am still dodging fucking COVID like I am Neo. So I am doing okay. Vice Victus, how are you today?
Oh yeah, once again, the evening quiet storm on your radio. They got the new mode. I turned my bass up, I think. No, I got a little under the weather, so I sound a little weird, but otherwise doing great, just holding it down. All good.
And back from a whirlwind international tour, Liam O'Donnell, looking kind of jet lagged still. How you doing today, bud?
Yeah, I'm feeling jet lagged and I feel like I've already cleaned up like three pukes of my kids since I got home. So there's a stomach bug here. I'm a little off as far as the time goes, but I'm happy to be home and had a great overall scout trip of UK and Thailand. And what a way to cap it off with the movie that we're going to talk about today. And then, yeah, we also have we're graced with a guest. Take him in, Mike.
Well, and really quick, I definitely want to talk about you watching it, because you went to one of the three-walled theaters that have the three screens. And I don't personally know anybody that's seen a movie in that type of theater. So I definitely want to pick your brain on that. But yes, we have a guest all the way from Sydney, Australia. So you, instead of listening to us Yanks, you get to bask in the glory that is his amazing Australian accent. You know him on Twitter as Celluloid Whiskey. Travis Johnson. Travis, buddy, how are you today?
G'day, cunts. I am fantastic.
I am good. I am so happy to be here. And I had to drop that C-bomb. Vice got pulled up for dropping a C-bomb on Twitter recently. And someone was like, oh, you said the C-word. And I inaugurated him as an honorary Australian, which means now he has C-word privileges.
You pulled the card. I love it. Yeah, because I meant it as you say it. Indeed. Yeah. Thank you for that.
But I love the C-bomb. I love saying cunt, because it's like, it's a circuit breaker for Americans. The most foul-mouthed American will say like fuck and shit and whatever, like all day long. And as soon as you say cunt, they're like, what the fuck? Like, that's the last linguistic taboo. But it's really important to Australian culture. Like, the Australian language is very subtle. And, you know, sometimes cunt means mate and mate means cunt. And until you can
I've heard
that
this
out,
yeah, like you say, what's up, mate? It's like, you want you some shit. That's yeah. Crazy to me.
You're right there, mate. Love this cunt. You know, it's like that. Which is why, like, Australians should not be moderated on social media, because Americans don't understand this. We're sometimes being really friendly and polite and welcoming, but you just hear the C-bomb and go like, delete, ban, bomb.
I have some Scottish friends, and it's a very similar thing. There's just some words that's just, you know, and it's like, yeah, it's fine, because it does. Not that we want to get into like a linguistic discussion here, but it does, I think, have a very different meaning in American culture. It's a very like misogynistic rooted term here. Yeah. In American culture.
See, Australian would never call a woman the C word. Okay. It's like it is generally used in a general way or for men, but you would never call a woman a cunt. Like, it's just, unless you really wanted to insult them. So like I said, very subtle language. You know, we're very complicated.
Very complicated. It's the same way I basically like to just walk into a room and go, sup fuckers. I mean, yeah, that's usually my intro is just sup fuckers. How you doing?
I like that this is a preamble to our discussion, because this is a very fascinating linguistic discourse about colonizer language. This is perfect. I love
it. Yes, it is. It's really interesting.
All right, Travis, we'll give you a chance to plug some stuff at the end, of course, but yep. For people who don't know, tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, who you write for, all that sort of stuff.
I write for everyone. I'm freelance. Just whoever will pay me. If you're listening to this and you have a commissioning budget, well, slide into my DMs, because I'm poor and hungry. I'm a film critic at large, basically. I sort of bomb around the place writing for whoever will have me. I write for SBS. I'm on ABC Radio. That's the Australian ABC, not the American ABC. Flix.com.au. Who else? Metro. Yeah, all kinds of places. Basically, anytime someone's like, would you like to earn some money giving your opinions on movies? I'm like, yes, when do you need it? Yeah, I've been doing this for 10 years now. It's actually just my 10th, or 13 years. It was my 10th anniversary of my first staff gig last week. Like, came up in Facebook memories. I was like, oh shit, I guess this is a career and not just a hobby that I've somehow monetized. I like action, sci-fi, horror, that kind of thing. And I'm very, very Australian.
And I will say, Travis and I have disagreed quite often, I think, on some movies, but other times we're completely simpatico. We were just joking about how we're basically the same person, just on opposite sides of the country. So, and we've been trying to get you on for a while, so I'm glad we were finally able to get you on for this one, because this is going to be a big week. So let's get into it. For those, like I said earlier, I have been quarantining, so I did not get to go see the $435 million globally grossing Avatar: The Way of Water, a movie that, you know, apparently has no cultural imprint. And I did not get to go see it, but that's what we're going to talk about. A couple other movies after. We're going to give some love to our boy Timo, of course, and talk about the big four. But first, let's start. So Liam, you are the guy who did the whole DGA thing and kept showing up in articles because of this. So you were by far and away out of all of us, I think, the most gung-ho for this movie. So
our listeners will remember from last week that you called me a pussy for not going to see it soon enough. And so after our podcast, I was like, well, let me just look it up. And then I saw, oh my God, Bangkok has like the most amazing theaters. It had all these different gags. A lot of them were really expensive, but they had like beds in them. And I'm not looking to like fall asleep in a 3-hour movie. So I saw this one, which we've talked about before, I see out of one eye. So I'm not interested in doing the 3D. I saw 3D IMAX of the first Avatar just because I wanted to see it on the biggest screen possible. But if I were to tell you what it looks like, is that it's basically I'm getting a dimmer image of the picture, and the parallax that they're using for the 3D is the blurry part for me. So if there's a nice deep like diorama thing, it's just like the background's all fucked up and blurry. And if there's stuff coming at the screen, that part's blurry. There's always one plane that I can see. So I've toughed it through a few screenings in my life, but I was like, fuck that, I don't want to do that. I saw they had the Screen X, which looked absolutely ridiculous. And it is pretty much, it didn't really even have three screens. It's just like they just projected onto the walls of the theater. And they're basically cropping into the center of the image. They're just stretching like the sides of the images off beside of you. So it is like a very, you know, like not exactly how the artist wants this thing to be presented. But I just was like, fuck it, I want to do something special. You know, I'm going to see, I saw it opening night in Bangkok. I want to try it. So when they showed the presentation at the beginning, which I posted online, like you could tell that was shot with three cameras, or at least had like three things finishing. It's not just a central 2D image that they're cropping and then splitting. So that stuff looks really cool. Like if you actually shot a movie for it, and whether you had a very wide angle lens, or you actually had two ancillary cameras, that could be, I think, an interesting thing to experiment with. I mean, it's kind of like the old like Cinerama scope or whatever, like in the old Cinerama domes where they would do stuff like this. But for this point, it did make you feel like you were in an aquarium for most of the movie. So that was fun, you know, but like sometimes it's late on the transitions and it's not quite ready for prime time. I would only do it for a movie like this. I wouldn't want to go see, anything that was like, you know, dramatic and you're doing that kind of stretching.
You're not chomping at the bit to see the Fablemans in Screen
No. You know what? As you mentioned, the Fablemans and everything, I just kind of, my coming out of this movie, my 30,000 view thing was just like, it was, I just felt like almost like a Catholic who was seeing fucking Jesus return. I was like, fucking, this guy went away for 13 years. I would trade the whole past decade of Spielberg films for one great film like this. Like he just cemented himself as my number one spot. This is my fucking goat. He delivered for me again. I can't fucking believe it. It was so good. I went, you know, I'm in Thailand. I went out. I had to immediately just get some Avatar tattoos, as you guys can see. Check this out. I'm just kidding. These are from my kids' Fruit Loops box, but I wanted to put them on for you guys.
I actually did get a new tattoo in Asia last week.
Whoa.
I saw these this morning and I was like, I had to shave my chest a little bit to get the Avatar A in here for you guys. But no, I was just fucking like, I couldn't fucking believe it. I really have enjoyed the movie, and I just thought more and more about it, and I'm just kind of completely all in on this series. And so yeah, that was my big takeaway. If all the buildup and the DGA brain broken and all that shit, I just was like, I can't believe he fucking did it again. So there you go.
Liam's so excited, his camera is bouncing up and down. It's fucking charming as hell. Like I'm loving the enthusiasm.
And it's also funny, when I showed up with the fucking flannel shirt on, Mike's like, why are you wearing a flannel shirt? It was the only shirt I had that would block the A tattoo mark on my chest.
We even had a whole like discussion about grunge fashion and how I've never gotten out of my 1992 Seattle, and that I still have flannel that's specifically designed to tie around my waist. You motherfucker! Like that was all bullshit. We had a good conversation, and it was all a fucking lie. For your
it was all a bit. I do it all for this podcast. I'm thinking of fucking bits for your fucking podcast all the time. Other I'm trolling people on Twitter for this podcast all the time.
Motherfucker.
See, I went goth instead of grunge. I like, you know, I saw The Crow at a very formative age, and it's just like, well, I guess I'm doing that for the rest of my fucking life.
I'm actually funny. I bounced between goth and grunge. Like, I literally, high school, I bounced between the two. I was the only guy who would wear a Depeche Mode shirt one day and a Pearl Jam shirt the next. Like, I just couldn't, pick. Because they were
just shattering paradigms.
They were all about pain. And that's really what it was all about, right? They were all about pain. Travis, you are, based on our conversations, perhaps a bit less enthusiastic on the movie. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah. So I want to couch this very carefully because, you know, the last time I didn't like a movie you guys loved, I got fucking dragged on Twitter for about a year. And that was Top Gun Maverick.
You're making a habit of being wrong about good movies. Yes,
I know, right? Keep going. I know. I'm a massive James Cameron fan. I love him. Like, he's one of my favorite filmmakers. I like to say, you know, he's a world-class self-taught oceanographer who occasionally takes a break to make the biggest grossing film of all time, and he does it with like clockwork regularity. It's just incredible. I'm a scuba diver. I just got back from Timor-Leste, where I spent 2 weeks diving on the coral reefs there, which was fucking amazing.
Which is that where you got your new tattoo, by the way?
That's where I got my tattoo. I'm such a cliche. I got an anchor tattoo. I was just like, on the last day in the country, it's like, I'm going to go get a tat. I'm going to get the most fucking obvious cliche nautical tat. I'm going to get the Popeye tat. So I did. So I'm a scuba diver. So I was like, and I love Avatar, love the original Avatar. There's an essay of mine out there where I went on for like 3,000 words going like, this is like, Avatar is the ultimate James Cameron film. Everything he's ever talked about, all his thematic concerns are in this movie. If you don't like it, you kind of don't like James Cameron. And I don't understand that. So I was in the bag for The Way of Water. All right. Like, I was so pumped, so stoked. I went to like they did a preview of like 15 minutes of 3D footage. And I was like, my mind was well and truly blown. I was like, fuck, I'm so excited. And I saw it on Tuesday. They did a press screening here. And it was a weird thing. It was a tiny cinema. It was in 3D and HFR. But it was like the smallest cinema at the complex where it was. And I liked it. But I didn't love it. I was just kind of whelmed. Not overwhelmed, not underwhelmed, just kind of whelmed. I was like, and I did, I know Liam hates this, I did a bit of script watching. I did a little bit of script watching there. And that second act fucking kills me. Like, it just, I don't know. Like, James Cameron historically has been such a tight screenwriter. Like, his scripts are just precision engineered Swiss watches. If you go and take a look at Terminator and Aliens and even Strange Days and stuff like that. Just a really tight writer where all the moving parts matter and they all mesh perfectly. And Way of Water is his most undisciplined and kind of sloppy and sprawling script, to the point where, and I couldn't believe this is happening, and this is an honest reaction, I'm not trying to, like, you know, rattle anyone's jimmies, rustle anyone's jimmies. It's an Americanism I'm not quite all fait with. But I just
I'm not sure that's an Americanism.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Whatever. Then maybe it's Canadian. I don't know. You all look alike to me.
Russell, your jimmies.
But I actually got bored hanging out in this world. I got bored hanging out on the reefs of Pandora, which kind of really surprised me. Because, you know, like, I love this shit. I'm in the bag for this. You know, I am the target audience for this movie. And I was just like, why the fuck are we still here? And why is nothing happening? And why are we following so many different characters? And no one really gets a payoff. Like, it's got real sort of middle movie energy. And I was kind of, just kind of vaguely disappointed. And I'm going to go see it again. Okay. And I'm going to see if I have a different reaction, because also, you know, I was tired. It's 3 hours long. You know, sometimes you're just not in the optimal headspace to watch a movie, which we as critics don't really talk about, but it's true. Like, your own emotional state obviously affects how you take in a film, even if you're a professional or, you know, quasi-professional like me. So maybe I just wasn't feeling it on the day. So I'll give it another shot. You know, I owe James Cameron that much. One of my favorite filmmakers. But man, I just, look, it's all right. It's fine. Could have been 2 hours. Didn't need to be three.
No, wrong. And I'll explain. Absolutely, you're missing. You're saying it's the most James Cameron like the for. But if you look at his last three movies now, with Titanic, Avatar, and Way of Water, he has zeroed in on an incredible thing that I think is a, like it's the most basic, rock solid storytelling principle that most movies completely, not necessarily ignore, but just aren't able to execute. And that's when people say these movies are simplistic, all that stuff. It's like, it's the level of execution of the simple theme or the simple storytelling principle at this high level is what matters. And that is, think about Act Two of Titanic, Act Two of Avatar, Act Two of Way of Water. They're very experiential, and they're one of the three of the few movies where you don't want conflict to happen to the people. You actually kind of want Jack and Rose to figure it out and end up being together. You want, like, Jake is really torn in the first Avatar between this mission, and he wants to be a good boy. He wants to be a good soldier. That's what he's always trained to do. But he's falling in love with Pandora. He's falling in love with Neytiri, and he's starting to lie to himself. He's deluding himself that maybe I could have this life. Mm. And you kind of don't want the conflict to come. You kind of want him to be able to do this. And even like he has that really uncomfortable confrontation with Kotrich where he's like, I need to finish this. And then he goes and has sex with Neytiri, like, you're a bonehead meathead. So then the Way of Water, it does that same thing. It's like, I don't know. I mean, listen, I'm a fucking meathead with four kids. I married, a beautiful warrior queen I'm undeserving of. I was very fucking, like, 100% this movie was aimed at me. I was struggling, all the same struggles of dealing with the different personalities and that, like, your kids aren't you and you're not who you were. And all of those things were just, like, within the first 2 minutes, I was already, tears were running down my eye. Like, I love the Sullies. And I completely was, like, understood. Especially maybe it's just like right now where we feel this existential dread about the way the world is going as a father, that I was just like, there's this urge to run away and to try to protect your kids. And so that was all just like 100% zeroed in on me. But then the second act is like, I just wanted Loak and Piacon, his whale buddy. I wanted them to just like hang out. I wanted everyone to do well. I was like, I really don't want anything bad to happen to these kids. And I think it's these second acts that have that experiential quality is why people go to rewatch these movies. They're not about like trying to be tight. They're about like get lost in the world, get lost in this love affair, get lost in this relationship. That's what I think is, he even said he did this whole thing with all the writers where they said what made Avatar work. And I think that's kind of the secret sauce. That's all I'll say.
No, really quick. No, I just want to say, as the host, I fucked up. I should have said this at the start. We are absolutely going to spoil the ever-living shit out of Avatar. So if you have not seen it, stop listening. Go see it. Like there's, even though I have,
go see it.
Even though I haven't seen it, I know there is no way we can talk about this movie without spoiling it. Hmm. And Travis, even you saying that you thought it was, you were whelmed, I think you would still probably say people should still go see.
Oh, yeah, go and see the film. Like, Jesus Christ, I don't want to discourage anyone from seeing this movie.
Yeah.
But I will say, when I was watching it, and I actually thought of you, Liam, because knowing what I know about you and your life, I was like, this is like, Liam's going to plug into this in a way that I don't. I consciously thought that when I was sitting in the cinema. It's like, oh, he's got four fucking kids, and oh, like, this is made for Liam. Like, he's all over. He's gonna eat it up with a
spoon. It really was. I was like, there was the moment like where the four kids, where I was like looking around the theater, like, is the simulation breaking right now? Like, why is this movie fucking made for me?
Yeah. So, and that's cool. That's fine. And I'm not bagging out the film. Oh, I am a little bit, I guess. But you know, I think they're legitimate criticisms. But someone made a good point. What's his name? The guy wrote Mandy, and he just did a segment. He did an episode.
Our friend Aaron Stewart on.
Yeah. So he did a really good tweet the other day when he was talking about Avatar, and he said the cultural footprint is actually like experiencing being in Pandora, because we don't have that connection to nature anymore. You know, for most people, the natural world is like, it's alien in a way that it never used to be. And, you know, in order to connect with nature, we have to watch these movies. And he was saying, like, you know, if they were making like a movie about the natural world, they'd probably use the same amount of CGI and stuff like that. And I was thinking about that after I saw the movie, because I'd just gotten back from Timor, and I just spent like 2 weeks underwater hanging out with fish and swimming with dolphins and shit like that. And I wonder if having that recent experience kind of fucked up the movie for me, because I wasn't feeling that sense of wonder, because I was sitting there going like, I was literally doing this last week. So
I think that actually is pretty accurate to that. I think that that would make total sense. It's like, if you're doing this adventure, if you're in that world, then it's not like the whales and the fish are like so far apart from our own ocean, right? It's a pretty one-to-one experience. It's just, you get to telepathically connect to them and call them bro, which is better.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. Last time I connected with a dolphin, one hit me in the balls. So that's my primal wound. When I was 8 years old, a dolphin snuck up behind me when I was at a place called Monkey Mire in Western Australia and stuck its rostrum between my legs from behind and went bam, 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 bam. Scared the shit out of me.
At least
you taking up diving was a way to get over that fear. Like, I'm not worried about sharks. Sharks will bite you accidentally, and it's like, oh, that sucks. But dolphins will fuck with you on purpose. You can't trust dolphins. So swimming with dolphins last week was like a real big kind of breakthrough for me, because I was fucking terrified.
And at least you didn't connect with them the way John McAfee did. Anyway, for those who don't know, just Google John McAfee dolphins, and then you're welcome for having that in your brain for the rest of your life. Vice, your thoughts on the movie.
All right, so first thing is, I saw it in the theater. I went to the biggest IMAX in the country, or at least up to this past month, because I hear in New York City, we have the IMAX in Lincoln Center, which was the biggest one until I think this past month, where there's one in Georgia, it's like a foot taller or wide or whatever. So whatever, either way. So I went for the full 3D experience as optimal as you can get it. And the other part is, before I started, is that I've had many of the threads defending the first film, so to speak. But the truth is that I haven't really revealed this yet, but I just, like, I don't really care about the first film, or I'm ambivalent. Like, I enjoyed it at the time as an experience, but, like, I don't really, like, think about it too much. But I just, what riles me up is all the, like, the weird, you know, it has no cultural impact, you know, like, there's all these stupid arguments. So I always, like, kind of fuck with people about that, about those. But the movie itself was like, sure, whatever. So, and I'd say I was prepared to, like, get my face molted off by the super 3D lasers and the fish and the, you know, fish fucking. But what I found was that it was actually a pretty serene experience. Like, I think for the first time, you know, I've heard Cameron talk about spirituality, and it's definitely there in the first movie, but I actually, for the first time, I felt that. So, you know, during this 3 hours and seeing his family and in the water, when he goes to Space Hawaii, meets the Space Samoans or whatever, like, it's, you know, it's like a whole new, like, I was just kind of like, yeah, I didn't want to think about anything. I just wanted to, like as you were saying, experience what this world is, dive into water with the fish people and the catfishes, catfish people, you know, checking out the oxygen starfish and the super whale and the asshole shark with the predator prongs, like all this weird shit, that, you know, weird cool sci-fi shit that you're not gonna see anywhere else. It's a movie. This is what movies are for. To show you shit you haven't seen before. So I was just kind of, I wouldn't say awe, but I was like, on the wave. I was like, yeah, I'm with this, man. You know, and it was a weird thing. It was like, I guess between the immersion of 3D and the what's being presented on the screen, the story, I was kind of clear headed. Like, it was a really interesting experience. Now that I think about it, but then of course, you know, this is still a action sci-fi adventure as well. With, you know, so then you see the other part, of course, is now we have the return of Quaritch as the thing he hates the most. He's a Na'vi person now, and, you know, they set that up. And them and his kids, you know, I love that even though they're CGI manifestations, you can still tell they had like soft boy faces. You know, you can see through it and into you. It's really cool. But then you have like his soft boy kids. And then you have Quaritch and his fucking goons, the jarheads, and it's just the image of like I guess this is the first act or the first chapter, I guess the first hour, where you have him and his cat kids, and then the cat goons, and like they're, you know, natural slash feral and their loincloths and knives. And then you have the Navi goons in the fucking blue Oakleys and the and the Velcro, like the Velcro dipping shit, like it, like they look like, you know, the tactical special force bullshit. That was such a strike. That was like, I had to like stop for a second. I was like, this is what Cameron does. He touches on something like deep tissue brain stuff here. That's all through imagery that is reflecting, like in the same way that Aliens, the Marines were iconic in their short time on screen. He did it again here, like this fucking perversion of his own natural beauty, imagination of the cat people. And now here we are. He puts all the tactical shit on them, and it feels like disgusting. It feels wrong. And I was like, yo, I'm fucking digging this. I like feeling uncomfortable like this, because I wasn't expecting that. I was just thinking, oh, hey, you know, he's gonna come back and, you know, do revenge. Yeah, plot. We're like, no, this is like, he's like soiling Pandora. I want to see where this goes, you know. So yeah, I was totally into the world and stuff. And so overall, I like this movie. Like, whereas I was ambivalent to the first one, I like this sequel. Like, I want to see it again. I want to like, not just for the visuals. I want to like be in the story again and like see all the cool shit. Because, you know, we have the Marine Navi, and you have like the fucking crab robots, and you have the fucking heart, Captain Australia, and Ahab, you know, like all this cool shit going on. It's like it's everywhere, you know, like. And yes,
the crab robots alone would give anything a good review for me. Like they, like I can't believe that they, like the asset, like the meetings that they had to go through on this design of a fucking like crab robot that just jumps off of a fucking ship. I was like, it's so pure. Well, it's so pure.
Yeah, I don't. I was gonna like kind of. I had my thoughts in order, but I just like kind of go random because that's how the show is. But people have always said that Cameron's one of his many gifts is that he has the ability to express the technicality of imaginary machinery, like, you know, the power loader and the Sulaco ship itself. So here in one part, when you see that when the crab robots, they have crab robots and they have like the submarine little miniature ones.
They're kind of dolphin robots. Yeah, the crab and dolphin robots.
One shot where the crab robots deploy off the boat, there's like a special like metal arch over the bow, the front of the boat. The crab robots grab the bar, then swing down into the water. Like he thought out how a crab robot would deploy in real life. So they had this special bar made for them, just like how a launch pad or a helipad has special architecture made for it. He went that deep into how this world works. I was like, this little tangible detail like that, like the crab robot arm bar. Like, that was like, yeah, I'm fucking...
He probably has a patent on the fucking crab robot. Like, there's actually, like, a design, and it's workable. He's, like, looking to sell crab robots.
Well, yeah, it's not just crab robots. It's like, how do we engage this? Like, same with the harpoon boat. Like, he had the whole sequence of where they're hunting away, like, step by step. I can almost imagine he's drafting out how to hunt this with this unreal creature. And then he's making it happen. Like, it's all this... levels to the stuff that he's doing, and but, you know, of course it mirrors our real world, how, you know, whalers, how we've been doing it in years past, but like this whole thing was set out. So yeah, I was really just like, yeah, I really was immersed, you know. People keep, they say that all the time, but I really was immersed in Pandora and in this new, like his new Hawaiian resort chapter of this story. So yeah, I dug it, man.
Because I had a slightly different reaction to the same stimuli, because when I saw the Oakleys, you know, the sunglasses, I just thought, who's making those big sunnies? Like, how big's the market? There's only about a dozen of these fucking guys.
They have boots measuring that size. They have cat size fucking Timberland. How do they do that shit?
Yeah. 3D printers. What are you talking about? They're going across the galaxy. Come on.
Then I went 3D printers. That makes sense. But it was just my initial reaction. It's like, who the fuck's making those?
I mean, it's not a spoiler because it is in the trailer, the skull smash. But like... that was like my one note is that he should have had Iron Maiden do a song, and it should have been the overture on Black for like 3.5 minutes before this movie started, and then maybe an intermission with the second half of the Iron Maiden song, because like the fucking the Quatrich's story is so metal, like, as so much of it is like, you know, the first, these two movies are like van art, like heavy metal shit, heavy metal cover art that I just fucking can't resist. But literally Quatrich like grabbing his own human skull and being like, pussy, and smashing it in his hand. It's like,
that's what I love. We do owe Avatar. It's like, you know, Avatar kind of gave us Stephen Lang. Like, he was around before. He'd been acting since like the late 70s, early 80s. But, you know, this was the, you know, Avatar's the film that made him. And everyone's like, oh, this guy's fucking incredible.
I mean, you go back and watch Tombstone, he's the coward, you know?
Like, he's
such a great character actor. Yeah. But, you know, he did a little TRT in 2009 and he's like, he became this whole other character, you know? Like, it's amazing.
Yeah, I wanted to say about that scene that this will probably like, reverberate in my comments as we go on. That's actually a pretty heavily dripping with subtext scene, like poetic. It's mythological. It's like he even says himself, like we've been resurrected from our past sins. Like, he kind of acknowledges, like, they go to hell and come back, or maybe he's in hell. Like, one can make a pretty like strong thematic case about what this means for this person, this soldier who's resurrected it to do more evil or whatever, and how he believes that. So like, yeah, like you said, like when he crushes the last remnants of his former self, but he's still himself. It's like, just to see your own dead body that was failed in battle, like just as a soldier, like, okay, that's a really strange thing to see. Because like when you think about, like, you know, I've seen. Your fallen comrades, you do think of yourself as well at certain points, but like, did to actually do that to see, oh fuck, I died, now I gotta do this right, better. There's a lot going on in there, especially for this particular character, like, who is all about the art of war. Anyway, this looks cool as fuck, you know. Like, there's a lot going on here that I think overall, but my biggest point is that people will say this is a simple story, and I guess it is mechanically speaking, but there's so much like just thematics you can go over, do the whole thing between Quaritch and the kids and who Jake is now and who his wife is now. Like, there's a lot going on here. And then also, you know, the fish.
but to stay on Quaritch is like, you know, on the whole, like, don't doubt Cameron thing, especially, I'd say, king of sequels. Like, I remember when it was announced Stephen Lang was coming back and I was like, huh? Like, I just kind of thought that was like, you know, that character was kind of a one and done. But when you talk about cultural footprint and stuff, like, I do think Quatrich is kind of the most iconic character of the first movie. You know, like, me and my friends used to always be like, a potent mix, you know, like, you do kind of his funny joking things of his stuff and you know, just sipping the tin cup of coffee as he's genociding an entire, you know, the world tree, you know, like, so there's a, I think, it, again, just being smart and realizing, like, this is what everyone's been introduced to. How could I bring it back? And to come up with this, I think the character, without, you know, without going into pure speculation, you know, because he's not the same character, like you said, he's a resurrected with that guy's memories. And there's a potential for growth that is really interesting. And I think we're going to go on a real journey with him, because they announced that he's in all of the sequels. You know, I'm hoping that we, you know, I think they said, you know, we'll get three no matter what. Who knows from there? But I just found him to be such a great villain, but without getting too much into the spoilers and where he could go, like, I think he could end up being the most interesting part of the whole story.
Yeah, because there's also part of this story there. Is that like, you know, in the original story was the in obtaining the energy source. But here, like, pretty deep in the movie, we find out what the actual, like, the big exploitation mineral or whatever is. And it's the whales are the spice. Like, so we find out that the whales have anti-aging serum, basically, inside of them. Because they're just magical on their own. It's, like, intelligent and beautiful and whatever. They also, like, have this stuff that the scientist says, or the captain says, like, stops the aging process in humans. So it becomes the most expensive, or the most valuable resource in the universe, even beyond the Inoptanium. And so like, that part of it, they don't really go into detail about the why of, well, I mean, because it's pretty obvious, why would anybody want that? Of course, just to live more. But so Jake has done that. He died and came back as a new life. Now Quaritch has done so. And, you know, we mentioned Steve Lang, like, the actor, he's getting older. And he, oh, by the way, there's a cool, like, men's health thing on YouTube of him. Like, and he says, like, he's he bulked up for the original role, but now he's like 70 something years old, right? So he can't do that anymore. So like, of course they're gonna be like CGI now, like that's perfect for him to like still act with his full power, but not have to like destroy his body like that anymore, because he can't. He's not a problem. But yeah, so they have this element of extending life or new life, and it's also Jake did that, and he surrenders his human part, but now he understands the way of Pandora, the way of water, the way of the nature, is that the cycle. He's part of his voiceovers. He understands the cycle of life and death. Like this is he now fully accepts through Pandora that life, we must die, and our life, the circle of life, you know, Mufasa. But you know, Quaritch, they kind of leave it open to say that they could potentially like keep coming back. Like they have found a way to cheat death also by, you know, doing this fucking data brain stuff into a new body. So he could potentially come back multiple times, but in multiple instances at the same time, possibly, if they want to do it that way. But that's also an interesting thing where the humans, the greedy, stupid humans, were so clinging to life to want to be reborn. But we see here in Pandora, like, no, that's not the height of, you know, we're supposed to let go. Like, that's the spiritual part. And I was like, oh, yeah, like, don't be afraid to die. You know, like, you gotta let this go. That's what happened. So that's the more, I guess, the philosophical bent on the conflict, not just, you know, them taking over the Indian lands to kill all the buffalo, whatever, to like, take over the oil. It's like they're fighting this ideological how to cheat life. And, you know, like, and the answer, I guess, quote unquote, is like, you're not supposed to cheat life. You gotta let it run its course. So yeah, all this interesting stuff going on. That again, it's like, it's just them fucking hunting big ass whales with exosuits, but like, it's all this like kind of all that spiritual mumbo-jumbo is part of that. All this cool stuff happening. So yeah, just a lot of stuff going on here.
I got a theory about Avatar, and it's a pie in the sky theory, but all the facts fit. And I think this is going to be revealed in one of the sequels. But I believe that the Na'vi are not native to Pandora. I think they are an extraterrestrial species, and they have they've populated the moon of Pandora, but they're not from there. And the reason I believe that is that all the animals on Pandora are six-limbed. They're all hexapedal. So they have a common ancestor. And James Cameron's a smart motherfucker. He's across this. And the Na'vi have four limbs like us. So I think the eventual reveal is going to be that Pandora is actually like a heavily engineered, like ideal paradise world for a former spacefaring race, which has decided to embrace this lifestyle as opposed to a lifestyle or a civilization based on conquest and exploitation. I think that's going to be the ultimate reveal. I'm probably wrong, but it's a good theory.
But you're not. I mean, that's not, like, again, I haven't seen the movie, but that's, you know, just knowing James Cameron, and I mean, knowing that he's got his self-sustainable farm in New Zealand and stuff like that. I mean, that's not, you're like, you could be wrong, but that's a really, actually really good fucking theory. I mean, and that's kind of the fun of this shit, right? Is we're going to get like three more of these movies so we can talk about it as we go on. But that's a really good theory, and it does fit in line with Cameron's views of the world. I mean, this is a guy that literally moved to New Zealand and decided to stay there so that he could create a sustainable, self-sustaining farm and so the idea again of, like you said, almost like a colonizer who decides to stop colonizing and instead create and build. I don't know, Travis, that's actually kind of fucking spot on. I don't know that that's where it's gonna go, but you don't need to worry that that's a like dumb theory. I think
I've been thinking about it since like 2009. It was the first movie. I was like, oh fuck this. And then when I was watching the new one, Way of Water, you get the underwater breathing jellyfish, and I was like, that's a bit fucking convenient. Oh, it's like there's a reason that this is intelligent design. Like, this is a manufactured planet. The reason you have the breathing jellyfish is because you want breathing jellyfish. You know, like it's deliberate. You know, it's weird. It's like a sci-fi creationism story, which is kind of odd. We don't really get too many of those.
So, and, let's see if we're back. What if he is?
You hit the nail on the head, too, though, that Cameron's not an idiot, right? Like, nothing, like, you don't necessarily need to agree with decisions that Cameron makes in his movies, but every decision that James Cameron makes in his movies is intentional and thought out. And, you know, you guys were just talking about, again, haven't seen the movie, but talking about the crab robots and the way that clearly, like, he's thought through all of this. So, to me, it's like, if there's something in a movie and you're thinking it might be this, odds are high Cameron's thought of it, you know, and he's either using it intentionally or he's using it intentionally to fuck with audience expectations. He doesn't do anything by accident. And that is, I am probably the least big James Cameron fan on this podcast. I have some real issues with some of his movies. For those who don't know, if you're wondering why Liam's being quiet, we lost him. He dropped out. He'll tag back in eventually. But
just gives me a chance to bag out the movie in peace, really. But here's why it sucks.
But I still think one of the things I love about Cameron is he is so meticulous. He is so meticulous. He is so well planned. I don't even want to say plotted. I was going to say plotted, but honestly, I think sometimes his plots are kind of messy. But he is so meticulously planned. And so I think that is actually a really solid theory, because I mean, this guy's spent fucking 13 years trying to make these movies. He's not just winging this shit. He's not, you know, God love him. I mean, we did an entire episode on how much we love Albert Pune, but he ain't fucking Albert Pune in this, right? Like, he ain't just being like, I'm just going to make this up as I go along and somehow manage to make an amazing movie. He's got this planned meticulously. And so, yeah, Travis, I love that theory.
But and also, like, I think one thing that you can, that's fucking brilliant. But also, like, he does also leave room for possible interpretations or bench on that too, because one thing is the spirit tree. Like, there was one in the forest. Now we see there's one in the water, so that might also be a part of it too. Like, and also they there's one pretty big unanswered question, that there's a whole big scene where Sigourney Weaver, she's back as Kiri, like her own Navi daughter. It's really weird. Resurrection, spiritual. But anyway, she's back as a teenager. And so part of her arc is that she seems to have a very direct connection to Ewa, the spirit of the, Gaia, as it were, to Earth, like the spirit of the world of Pandora. And so, like, and she's trying to figure out how to, they kind of, it's actually a funny joke about how she was her immaculate conception. Like, they're like, who knocked your dead mom up? It's a pretty funny joke. Like, it's actually like an unsolved or unanswered mystery by the end of the movie, is where did she actually come from? So that might be another avenue of that too. Like, what do these spirit trees have to do or have a say in this whole, how this world has come to be? Because that could be another part too of it, because they're definitely like making it clear that that's an ongoing important part of the story. I mean, it always was, but like the fact that there's more of them now, there might be the tree could be the alien, you know, you never know. It's all the stuff is going on.
Avatar as a world has a tangible, measurable afterlife. I mean, the subplot running through the first film, we get Sigourney Weaver saying, you know, there are neural links between the trees and they're more complex than the human brain. So Avatar as sort of a Gaia theory kind of living world is like, Pandora has a Gaia theory living world, is a big part of it. And I think we're going to explore that in depth as the movies go along.
Yeah, I mean, that theory of, sorry guys, I lost my power. Too many heaters running at once. But I think the Sigourney Weaver thing, I mean, if you remember the first Avatar, they're trying to transport her consciousness into her Avatar body, and that doesn't work, even though everyone was praying together. So I think that is literally the impregnation is in that moment, but they don't really want to go there yet in this movie, because Kiri is sort of like, you know, she's kind of a chosen one in her ability to manipulate the world. So I don't know, that's really where my brain was going. But as to the joke vice, and when you guys say, when I say like my ranting and raving about how great this movie is, I love the flaws of Cameron movies. Like, to go into Cameron movies, like, he'll spend $500 million on a movie that's like, it's called A Fist, Bitch, and a dude punches another guy in the face, and like, that he always has cast kind of odd actors. It's never like the simple down the middle prestige actors that some of his contemporaries have. I mean, look at Michael Biehn. He's like, he's a unique energy, and it's not like he's had this huge career outside of his Cameron collaborations. Like Cameron kind of like is drawn to a certain sort of authenticity that I think is his own specific lane. And that's like the Spider Kid is a very weird performance. It's a very weird role. And when I saw some of the early stuff at the DGA screening, me and Josh Cortez, who are on this, we were like, hope Spider's not like, doesn't ruin this one. Like, I don't know, hope this kid doesn't like deep six it. But I actually thought, one, he's not in the movie that much. He's a very, I'd say, supporting role. And two, like, he kind of fell into a Cameron groove to me, where he is drawn to his own weird troupe of actors that aren't necessarily like what you would consider these like mainstream thespians, but they're like his energy. And I was like, oh, this kid's got Cameron energy. That's why he likes
it. Exactly. Yeah. Cause like on his face, he's a bizarre, stupid character. Like, why is this kid in a loincloth and a mask? Like, he looks ridiculous.
I just kept saying, put some JNCO jeans on this kid. Like, come on. Why do I gotta keep seeing him in the loincloth? Yeah.
Like Chad Kroger looking ass. Yeah. But like, he works for this thing. Like, he's this weird, this second generation amalgamation of what this human Navi alliance looks like. Jake was the original, the forebearer of that, but then now he's kind of, well, even he's, because he's fully Navi, but he's still also a Marine, which is his own weird thing. And he has Spider, which is, and here's the big reveal, is that he's Porch's biological son. So family drama. And again, that sounds like dumb on its face, but it totally works for the movie. Like, with all the stuff about resurrection awesome. And lineage and legacy and your future, like, Quaritch is to die, and his son would be the spiritual amends of his evil. But no, he came back as another demon now. Like, they can't, and then in this movie, his sin manifest, his Navi body, and his absolutely manifests his son, who is now in peace with the Navi. They meet and they have a tension, like, how, what is the legacy of this person supposed to be, of these humans? Or like, again, this is like, he gets a kid's fucking white cloth, and at the climax, he's in a white cloth and a fucking scuba mask. Like, this looks fucking ridiculous, but he's doing some deep shit with this thing.
Thinking about Cameron's energy, I think what it is it's blue collar, it's working class. I think James Cameron really likes just working guys. That's his thing. He's not a military guy, even though he deals with the military a lot in his films, but he is a blue collar guy. He wants, like, The Abyss is probably the best expression of that theme in his work. It's like, he's just, he just likes dudes. He just likes hanging out with guys who bring together and do tough jobs, Like, that's his thing. He never went to uni. He's a former truck driver. He's all self-educated and shit. And I really like that about him. But he just likes dudes, just like bros rule, right?
But that's also like what I was talking about him compared to these other directors. And like, if you think about it, even just like the state of movie making and everything that we've been talking about on this podcast for the past couple of years, of how the blockbusters are sort of this made by committee thing, and sort of his contemporaries have either sort of fallen away or kind of left the blockbuster, arena. And here it is, like, the last fucking man standing, like the king of the world. And like, he's still fucking doing it. And so you do get these things that you haven't seen in blockbusters in a lot of different ways. Like where Vice was saying, thinking out, the crazy minutiae of how all these machines work, but also just like, he can be horny on main. Like, he's just like, hey, I'm kind of horny for this fish lady. Like, take a look at her. And like Marvel just doesn't do that. Like, they don't like what you just like it. Literally, she comes out of the water and flings her hair back, and it's like you're watching like a 1950s Bash at the Beach type of thing, where you're like, oh my god, like, you really want to fuck this bitch, which is
James Bond, isn't it? It's the Bond girl emerging out of the ocean.
But I like that. I like that. That there's no one. There's no corporate overlord that's being like, hey, James, chill it on the sexy shots of the fish ladies. And I'm like, no.
Because you see, like, the same thing, like the hot-blooded young boys, the cat boys, they're like, oh man. Like, it's the same old kind of thing we've seen in all kind of teen movies, but they just happen to be cat people. But like, it's still like that spirit transcends. Like, oh man, check this girl out. You know, it's great. It's
fun. I mean, they like in the extended cut of the first movie, like the sex scene's pretty long, and it's in both cuts. But like these movies have sex in them, and I think that's like. It's not a small thing, especially us people who are terminally online, who've had to listen to everybody complain about the lack of sex in these movies. And then they complain about, they don't really acknowledge it because, you know, there are other species than humans. But I think it's something, again, it's just like the fact that it's one guy and he's allowed to kind of, you know, he's brought in a team of writers this time. He did have other writers on the first one. I know, Leta, I can't remember her last name. She was an EP, but she worked on the script with him in the last one. So it's not like he's never worked with other writers before, but you still kind of feel it all filtered. And it's like we said, like the expression is just, it's just very pure. And to be on such a big grand scale and still get weird sort of offbeat flaws and kind of like feeling like there's at least one human in charge of what things are going on, that to me is why I'm still just like so joyously celebrating the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And the idiosyncrasies make it is the odd choices, which manifest Cameron's voice, if you will. I am concerned how the crush dynamic between Spider and Curie is going to pay off, because there is a size differential and he's going to have to climb her like a trellis. That's a movie or two down.
We're all thinking it.
How good is Sigourney Weaver in this thing? If we can circle back to her for a bit. Like, I never disbelieved that character for a second. I thought that was a fantastic performance. I thought the realization of Curie as a just a person in that world was just top notch. Like, all killer, no filler. Loved it.
Another crazy thing that you read in a press release where you go, what the fuck are you guys on? What are you guys doing? Like, what are you talking about? And then, yeah, it absolutely incredible. I thought she was gorgeous. And it did sort of open up these ideas, like our friend of the show Brandon was saying, like, why not bring Schwarzenegger in for the next one? And
let's get Arnold and Michael Biehn.
Immediately thinking Arnold would be like a general Navi, but then someone said make him a teenager, and I was like, oh god, my brain exploded. Horny Arnold back in the movies? Yes, let's get him back there. Like.
They should bring back Jeanette Goldstein as well. As long as we're going back to the Cameron players company, you know, his deep bench of character actors. But bring back Vasquez and make her something weird.
Hey, absolutely. I mean, that technology is quite incredible. And it was, again, just like, he knows what he's doing. Again, he's using an iconic part of the other movie and repurposing it and then creating like a deeper mystery. And then just the littlest daughter reminded me so much of my 6-year-old Pearl that I was like, every time she was in danger, I was like physically ill. And I was very upset. And I was like, if they fuck with the little girl, I'm going to freak out.
Because they don't show away from like, you know, the danger of it all. But yeah, I'm like, every time those fucking Navi goons get their hands on the kids, I'm like, oh my god, somebody please stop them. Please, I wanted to let
they had our kids. They had their knife under our kids' throats. Yeah. So I was like,
you kill them all so very badly. Like, how dare you? You know, it's just perfect villainy. Just like hard ass, dumb ass goons who don't care. They're like, we doing this, boss? You know, burn the hooches. All this, you know, old school, like, uncaring U.S. soldier shit going on. Oh, it was perfect.
And like Travis, I'm sure, like me, like I remembered all the goons from the first movie. Like I'm like, oh yeah, that's that goon. That's this goon. Like as a fucking first movie nerd, I was like, I can't believe they brought back goon number 5.
One thing I want to say is, you know, I love listening to this conversation because one of the things we've talked about on this show, and to quote Liam, you know, the de-aging and stuff like that is it's anti-art, it's anti-human. And what I love about this conversation is it's the technology itself is morally neutral. It's how the technology is used. And to me, that's always been the thing with Cameron, is he is always using technology in a way that is designed to advance art as opposed to giving us certain Jedi that looks 25 years younger, you know, or so what, however you want to do it, right? But I'm loving listening to this because you guys are literally having the exact same conversation we had about The Mandalorian, but on a very different side, because it's in the hands of somebody that understands it as a tool for art, not a replacement for art. And so again, I mean, I was already.
No, I think that's amazing point, Mike. It is. And it does speak to some of the things that came out, like, you know, one of the big things when I was saying this broke my brain is because it's like, do you really need to performance capture underwater? Because we kind of can animate people swimming, right? And the question that you can't really answer that other than the fact he wanted to, because he wanted to go through that process. He wanted to work with the actors. He wanted to work underwater. And, you know, through his own success, repeated its astronomical success, he put himself into a position to do the most difficult process to do it. And so, like, it does go with that same sort of, like, ethos of, like, wanting to work with actors to do something interesting and new and not just kind of give fans what they want, like some regurgitation or fan service. He's like, you know, I love Sigourney Weaver. I'm going to figure out a role for her. What if we did this? I don't know. Yeah, I think it's a great point because we can be really anti-AI on this show, which I still am. And I found it fucking insidious that the AI is now just flattering people and making you guys all look better than you are. You know you don't look that good as your fucking fake AI thing. Stop posting it. It's not impressing anybody. Insidious, evil shit going on with that. But there is obvious AI that goes into VFX and animation and image simulations and all of the things that I've used in my own career. So I'd be a hypocrite to say, like, all this technology is bad. I love VFX, you know, so it's just about how you're using it.
Yeah, there's a clip going online right now going viral about the AI and the legendary Hayao Miyazaki, the Japanese animated director. He's in a board conference with his animators, and they're showing him like tests of AI generated motion. And the clip is subtitled. He's appalled. He even says, like, you know, this is an insult to humanity. Like, that's what he says. Cause, like, and again, with Cameron, like, you can tell that he's using this stuff. He's not just making this, like, he's not just using technology to, like, make random shit. It's very human. There's a soul to all this stuff. You know, even with all the HDR and all the 3D, like, there's still a human soul behind all this that you don't really see with other kind of, I was going to say, like, you know, the basic superhero Marvel, DC, whatever. And I'm trying to, like, make that whole argument again, but, like, it really is that, like, that stuff is kind of made in the, you know, in the factory, so to speak, and, you know, it has its purpose. But he's, like, taking his time. He's an artisan using this tool to make human art, which is something very important that we need to, like, consider.
And if those of you at home are wondering what that meowing is in the background, my cat is being a fucking asshole. So
I have four cats. We're pro cat on this podcast, so there's no problems there.
Here, guys, I wanted to touch on this because before I forget, too, it's also, I think, important to me personally and to the listeners as well, because we are Action for Everyone. So one of the things that I always had issues with was, you know, the whole white savior appropriation thing. Well, my issue is that that's not the case really in this original first movie. Because he kind of subverts that, and that one, he kind of surrenders his humanity, his whiteness, quote unquote, and two, you know, like the Indians win, quote unquote, like the Native Americans don't win in Death of the Wolves, they don't win, the creatures don't win in Ferngully, like they get fucked up in history, but the Avatar, the original movie, kind of subverts that. So then, of course, you know, here the sequel, they come back and for vengeance to humans, so, and that's where we're gonna figure out what happens next. But one thing I noticed was there's still some contention issue with the overall use of Native. Well, it's not exactly Native American or Indigenous peoples, but, like, that's the reflection of what he's doing in these movies to our real world, and part of, like, and there's some interview he had, like, from, like, 10 years ago that's resurfaced about that, like, how he's talking about how the Native tribes could have fought harder, something like that, or like, you know, like, and that's his kind of vision behind the story. Like, what if they actually won, you know? But, you know, I can, it's very clear that, you know, to an indigenous person, that could be offensive on his face. You know, I totally understand that. So I don't want to, like, dismiss any of those concerns out of hand. But I just, I mentioned this in passing before, but, like, you know, yes, I'm a Black African-American, but I'm also, I'm Guyanese, first generation. My mother is indigenous from the, you know, Central South American area. These concerns aren't, like, ignorant to me. I'm not totally ignorant of what's going on here. But also, with that same context in my living days before my ancestors, I was in the army, so I went overseas to invade other people's lands to conduct war. That was, you know, during my service, Iraq, Afghanistan, and so forth. At the same time, though, I was an intelligence analyst in the army, and the intelligence analyst school is in Fort Huachuca, Arizona. When you go to Fort Huachuca and you see there the on-base museum, the entire base, its history is dedicated to the Buffalo Soldiers. These are, of course, the famous troop of African-American soldiers in the 1800s who helped, as they say, clear the way for expansion into the West for years to come. So with that, my legacy, as it were, is also that, because, you know, here we have our people, my people, that were brought here against their will. And in order to, like, try to better their position in life, they fought against and killed these indigenous peoples. So this is very, I'm not trying to dismiss people's concerns about how Cameron uses these indigenous tropes or indigenous materials. But I think that the issue with what I want to say is that this is the kind of the messiness of sci-fi in general. Like, there's always going to be this tension. Like, one example is, like, the Planet of the Apes, classic legendary series of films and stories, and you know, but, you know, the central metaphor, allegory of that is racism. It's basically, what if this other civilization treated white people the way white people treat black people? Like, that's the actual allegory going on. But we would use the term problematic now, but, like, but just back then, the hump to get over, or the tension in that story, is that that kind of makes the apes the black people, like, kind of, you know, it's just, yeah. Again, of course, the long going racial stereotypes and insults about black people, monkeys, whatever. So yeah, that's it's a silly thing to think of, but there's still actual real history behind that. So there's nothing wrong, quote unquote, with Planet Apes. It's just like, that's just part of the natural tension of making an allegory from with sci-fi on a real issue. Like, it doesn't always a one-to-one. There's always gonna be that friction of, this can't always work. Even again with, like, Lovecraft, you know, famously, like, he created a whole genre, basically, you know, all the cosmic sci-fi stuff. But that came from his, like, racist. He was, like, he's insanely racist. That his to him, everyone not white was alien. Like, that's part of the uncomfortable tension of sci-fi to express these ideas. So I just wanted to make it known that, you know, I want people to, if you have an issue with how Cameron addresses or uses these concepts of indigenousness, that's the right word, in the movies, I totally understand and respect why would be offensive to you, why that causes you, if you don't want to see it, whatever. I think there is merit in him exploring this stuff, as messy and uncomfortable as it is. And again, you know, like, like Lee said, this movie speaks to you as a white guy with four kids in an interracial marriage, you know, like,
yeah,
like, you know, like, that's real too. And in my case, you know, like, you know, part of that quote that I mentioned before, like, you know, what if the Indians fought harder, whatever, something like that, is like, what if back then the Buffalo Soldiers didn't fight? What if they fought against their mat? You know, what if they fought for the Indians? You know, or me? What if when I went over there, I could have actually helped Afghanistan not collapse? This is part of the fantasy for me in these movies. Is like, I can imagine a different way this could go, a different way this could play out, a different way we could make things right. And then, you know, just with that kernel of imagination, I guess the idea is that we can try to figure out a real way forward in some way. So I don't want to dismiss those concerns about the movie, but I also want to say, I don't want people to dismiss the merits that are here also, because there's a lot you know, this worth here for us to discuss and, you know, and to work through. And I hope that, you know, so I definitely want to see, you know, films in the future, how they deal with this stuff. But, you know, just me as a quote unquote marginalized person, this means a lot to me as well, even though it's about, you know, a white guy going feral or whatever you want to call it. You know, that, and that, again, that's the power of Cameron's movies, that they're so universal that they can touch on these very real subjects, very real experiences of different people, but still mean something. So yeah, just I want to make a step before we go to the next time, because that's, and I want to see how this develops over time, the next three, four movies now, because I'm hooked now. I'm in. I want to see it.
No, I know. I'm so glad you brought that up, because, you know, obviously saw a bunch of tweets about that as well. And it's obviously quite tricky. You know, there's some of that stuff where it's like the press tour thing, like him talking about he was imagining that in the future. And I could see that being totally offensive to Indigenous people. I guess it's like the thing I it always goes back to like intentions and like where is this person's heart? And I guess from the Cameron fanboys perspective, and when you think about all the different heroes that we've all had growing up and like where they've ended up, I think the thing that I find the most like hopeful about his story and his journey kind of as a person, as a fan following him, is that he kind of was a dick when he was younger. And he was kind of like he was just so much smarter than everybody else he was working with all the time, that he would constantly be kind of, you know, snapping at people and impatient. And, you know, he even said in the recent stuff on this about how he's like finally felt like he rid his body of the poison of testosterone. Now, we're obviously a pro-testosterone podcast, but I understood what he meant by that, which is just like the toxic masculinity aggressiveness. And I don't know, it's very unique that someone's like one and made all this money consistently, and they've actually become a better person. Like, when does that fucking happen? Like, everybody that we like they keep getting worse and worse generally. And at the end, you're like, oh man, this guy's a fucking asshole. But he's making more and more empathetic movies that are, he's putting more and more time into, you know, positive messages in these movies and conservation. I mean, this is a fucking $500 million anti-whaling screed. It's about fucking save the whales. Here's $500 million for it. Like, I don't know. So that to me is where I guess I'm able to say, like, I understand that, but I'm so wrapped up in kind of like this guy inspiring me to do what I do and see that, like, oh, you know, like a lot of the people that are his contemporaries or even came after him have kind of gone off the rails in different ways. And this guy's kind of still trying to make movies about how you should like love the earth and love your family. And so I was like, I don't know. I guess that's my Cameron defense.
Someone also mentioned that, you know, that the film comes off as very conservative. And we said many times here, you know, it's kind of like an unavoidable aspect of action movies in general, is that there is a conservative core to them. You know,
what is the conservative core to this?
Oh, no, just like, for me, it's like he says that,
guys, hold on. We haven't heard from Travis for a bit. So let's let Travis, like,
okay.
I was enjoying the piece. I was just going to say that I found it funny, like, when he did that interview, it's like, you know, I rid my body of the poison of testosterone, and a bunch of like right wing dickheads on Twitter were like, oh, fucking pussy. Oh, he sold out. Oh, he used to be cool. And it's like, motherfuckers, do you realize how tough and cool and smart James Cameron is? Like, I'm not sucking his dick here, but like, he's dived the Marianas Trench. He's tougher than you. All right. He rescued Guillermo del Toro's dad from kidnappers. He is a hardcore motherfucker. You cannot bitch him out for like not being a fan of being a young hothead anymore. You know, like, it's just ridiculous. The fragile masculinity you get in these online spaces, and they try and take down someone who is just demonstrably, he said in English, demonstrably just tough and cool as fuck. Like, you cannot bag out James Cameron on that level. You can find fault with his films if you like. You can say he used to be an asshole. You can say he's got an ego on him, king of the world, all that shit. But he's still a tough motherfucker. Like, you cannot take that from him.
I love it. But Vice, what were you going to say about the conservative? Because I saw that, but then I read the article and there was no good points made. No, so
that's part of it. Well, just in the movie itself, like, you know, it's not an issue to me, but like, you know, I guess people would have, when he says several times, the father, the job or the father to protect, you know, that's kind of classical. That makes sense. Right. But, you know, like, one might think, well, wouldn't it need to be to like, to teach or pass on, you know, like he's very much, you know, this is again, but this character is a meathead Marine. He's all about, you know, defending like his concept of family is to protect the house, you know? And, you know, yeah, some people, you know, it's just some people like that leans too much into like, you know, like how there's a very weird, strange, like all these like Doom Prepper guys. And then, like, they like have all the guns.
Oh,
and stuff, like,
guns and stuff, okay.
And like, it'll be like,
yeah,
you know, like
they're just stuff. Missing the entire point of the ending. Then that's right, that's right. Too bad.
Yeah, like, yeah, because like, well, like, well, I mean, it's this point, like, you know, the whole concept of like the father preparing for the worst, but then you like, do you know first aid? Do you know how to, you know, stop poisons? Do you know how to like mend a broken leg? Like, they're all concerned about the physical violence stuff. Like, they're not concerned about the actual useful protective stuff that makes a good father, that would make a good man and good father. So yeah, that's part of, I think that some people misconstrue that, his line of the character's reasoning for that. And you know, and like you said, in the movie he's proven basically wrong in a way. Well,
yeah, I mean, I think from like a character arc standpoint, when he says it at the beginning is not the same meaning as when he says it at the end. Yeah. And I mean, when I say like the non spoiler thing, but like the one thing I would say about will this have the legs of the first one, and it's an interesting thing about Top Gun Maverick that I was talking about, is that Top Gun Maverick, you know, you have the Val Kilmer character passing away, but he, from the moment you see him in the movie, you know he's going to die because he's already very diminished, right? But there's the rest of Top Gun Maverick is pretty much a celebratory feel good movie. And there is an ending to Way of Water that is not feel good at all. It kind of brings things up a little bit, but it is, really emotionally difficult. And so that was what I was wondering, like, oh, is this going to have the legs of the first Avatar? Because there's nothing in the first one that ever hits you as hard as this one did. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, but the entire thesis of the father protects, that's what gives him meaning, I think gets completely transversed at the end, and it takes on a deeper dimension. And God, that fucking ending, the flashback stuff was just like,
yeah, that's, yeah.
I was sitting there like in the car the next day, just like trying my eyes. The Uber driver's like, what's going on with this guy? I'm like,
Even like to be less spoilery, like the fact that he finally accepts, quote unquote, his soft boy son, because his soft boy son basically helps save them, like with the power of empathy. Like, that's his whole deal. He's like, he's an outcast. He's like, he's not as strong as the other guys, but like he connects with this other outcast whale, and you know, they become kin. And like, that's like, he couldn't do that if he was just a hard ass jarhead all the time. He had to be open to like relationships with other people, other entities, other life forms. And that's what saves the day. Not just, you know, that dope ass hand to hand fight at the end, because that's actually dope.
Oh, all right. But can I just talk about one thing, Mike? That this is, but PyaCon is
hour
the,
and a half, Liam. We're
yeah,
an hour.
We're almost there. PyaCon is the Tolkien that Loak bonds with, and so everything is drawing to a head in once you get into this third act, and the king of the third act, Cameron, starts to rear his head. And PyaCon, once he comes back into the fold, it's like you're at the gym and you're ready to do the max lift and you're just smashing things around. Like, he throws a fucking tantrum across the entire ocean floor. And yes. I was just like, oh shit. And
he was hulking out, man.
He was fucking hulking out.
His own.
I was losing my mind, and it fucking completely paid off. And then yes, the hand to hand fight, what does he say? Like, let's get on with it. Like, this, he always does the right fucking tough guy one liner, like shit. And I gotta just say, we've talked about everybody else. I don't know if you guys talked about it. Sam Worthington, who is from the town where Travis is from, is fucking awesome in this movie.
Travis, you haven't let talk for like 20 minutes.
Well, now we got a good place for him.
I'm just impressed that Liam's got all the character names just locked, just fucking dialed in.
One view.
The movie last week, and he's like, I've got it memorized.
Fucking Sam Worthington, I've always liked him in the first movie, but it's like that Cameron energy where some of the line readings are like a little like I felt like he was 100% comfortable and dialed in on this one. So tell us about Sam Worthington, because you've seen him come up from the get go.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, and I've interviewed him a couple of times, and I've done set visits with him and shit. And yeah, he's a good guy. Wurtho, yeah. You got the Australianism, so it's not Sam Worthington, it's Wurtho. And it's not Ben Mendelsohn, it's Mendo. That's how we do it here.
I think it's very important to point out that Sam Worthington was in one of my favorite movies of all time, which is Dean Perry's Boot Men, which is...
Oh, wow. That's his first role.
Yep. Yeah. And he's terrific in it because I love fucking Tap Dogs. I love Dean Perry. I wear blunnies because of Tap Dogs.
That's a cultural footprint.
Yeah, that's it, right? That is a fucking cultural footprint right there. I wear fucking $200 shoes because 20 years ago, some dude in Australia decided to weld some steel plates to his shoes and fucking tap dance. Like, that's a cultural footprint right there.
Amazing. Incredible. If you want to see a cool Sam Worthington film, there's one from 2002 called Dirty Deeds, directed by a dude called David Caesar. And Wurtho plays a soldier in Vietnam, an Australian soldier who like demobs, and he goes back to Sydney and hooks up with his uncle, who's played by Brian Brown. And Brian Brown's a gangster running the pokey machines, like the slot machines in Sydney. And the American mafia are trying to muscle in, and their representative is John Goodman. So it's got a great cast, and Toni Collette turns up in it. But what it's really about, and this is ahistorical, but it's cute, is the introduction of pizza to Australia. Because in the first scene, Wurtho's out in the field in Vietnam, and some Americans are there, and they're getting food dropped off. They're getting like rations, and it's pizza. And he's like, oh, what the fuck is that? So there's a subplot running through the entire film where he's sort of running around the back blocks of Sydney trying to find someone who can make this food that he experienced. And John Goodman ultimately is like, here's how you make a pizza. So it's this cute little cultural exchange, and completely ahistorical because we had a massive Italian population then anyway. Like, we had pizza and we had good coffee. But it's just this cute little film, and it's got that veteran thing going on and crime crossover. So Vice, I think you'd get a kick out of it. If you can track it down, make time for it. Dirty Deeds, named after the AC/DC song.
I will also say his Macbeth is pretty fucking, his like John Woo influenced Macbeth, I think is, Travis is shaking his head. He doesn't.
I am not a fan of that one. Did not enjoy it at all. So that's from the director of Romper Stomper.
Yeah. I actually I liked that one. I thought that one was pretty good because I am a sucker. I will fully admit I am a sucker for modern. My favorite version of Hamlet is the Ethan Hawke Hamlet, where he does the to be or not to be in a fucking blockbuster. Yeah. I have a real weakness for like modern updates of Shakespeare. And so for me, I do like Sam Worthington's Macbeth. Travis does not. I'm going to assume I'm on the wrong end of this one. But I do enjoy it.
To be fair, I saw it once when it came out, and it has never cross paths with me again. So maybe I'll give it another spin in a week or two, and I'll circle back and tell you if you're right or wrong.
Fair enough. Because I know if I'm wrong, you're absolutely going to be more than happy to tell me I'm wrong.
It's my favorite thing to do in the entire world.
All right, boys, we gotta move on from Avatar. So I'm gonna go around the circle here and just give everybody last minute thoughts. So Liam, last thoughts on Avatar.
Go see it. Go see it again. I'm definitely going to go see it again. I already watched the first one, the theatrical again. I usually watch the extended. I'm going to go watch the extended of the first one again and then see this one again. And my troll tweet is that there are now just as many great Avatar films as Star Wars films. Discuss.
Oh, wow. Go fuck yourself. Right.
Nope. A New Hope, Empire. One, two. The rest are all pretty good.
Fuck yourself right into the sun. Vice, your final thoughts on
so, that. Yeah, well, actually, forgot to mention, regarding the HFR stuff, so I saw it in 3D HFR, and one of the big press points is that he mixes both. He does certain dramatic scenes in traditional 24 FPS and then 60. And I felt that it was the high-res stuff on land looks kind of terrible, actually, honestly. Mm. There's our opening train attack sequence. And it looks so lifeless. Weightless is the word. Whereas what Cameron mentioned, that it works better underwater. But so just, I don't know, that's something I noticed that after seeing, as it happens, my wife this morning was seeing, watching the original Avatar on Disney Plus, and certain scenes felt better in the traditional frame rate than what I saw last night. So my point is, definitely go see, just check it out for, you know, you got to see the biggest spectacle in the world, because otherwise why watch movies? And I do think personally it's a better film than the first film. If you didn't care about the first film, I think this has enough to make you care. But if you're still on the fence with all the uncomfortable racial stuff, then this probably won't sway you. But you know, it's still a lot of stuff here worth talking about. I probably will see this again in a regular frame rate, just to like fully solidify the experience. But yeah, I really enjoyed this.
Travis, final thoughts, because you are the one who likes it the least out of the three.
But I don't hate it. Like, I don't dislike it. We gotta establish that. Make sure people are across that. And it turns out I have many final thoughts, because Vice just reminded me of that train sequence, which I really like, because it's kind of James Cameron going fuck you to some of his critics, because, you know, the classic criticisms of Avatar is like, oh, it's just Ferngully, it's just Dances of Wolves, it's just Pocahontas. And with that train sequence, he's just going, well, now it's just Lawrence of Arabia. Fuck you. You know, like, he literally just does the train raid from Lawrence of Arabia straight out of the gate. I love that. Who's out there tattooing those whales? I think is a good question. Like, all the whales have Moko, like Maori tattoos. And like, I can't tell if they're supposed to be like, and you know, the aquatic Na'vi have them as well. And I can't tell if they're supposed to be like naturally occurring markings, or it's some kind of ritual or cultural thing or whatever.
I totally just got a mental image of, so Travis, this probably didn't make it down to Australia, but there was an old US commercial for Dunkin' Donuts of this dude that would get up at 5 a.m. and be like, time to make the donuts. And now I just have this mental image of this dude being like, time to tattoo the whales.
Time to tattoo the whales. We didn't mention that the leader of the aquatic Na'vi, whose name escapes me, but Liam will know it. Is played by the great Cliff Curtis, like New Zealand's greatest actor, Uncle Bully from Once Were Warriors, who can play like any race, apparently. Like, he's a Maori guy, but he's played like everyone. I think he's Training Day.
You ever had your ship
training, homie?
Three Kings. He plays Iraqi. He's Iraqi in Three Kings. Yeah. I actually was in a Twitter conversation just last night with a friend of the show, Jackson Bourne, about how fucking great Cliff Curtis is, how he is almost always the best thing in any movie that he shows up in.
He just did a movie. I hosted a Q&A with the director, and sadly not Cliff Curtis, but one of the other actors who's actually a Maori activist. He did this movie called Muru, which is based on a true story of Maori resistance and land rights in the modern day, like in the 21st century. And it's fucking fantastic. But also Cliff Curtis, I think, is the only Maori actor ever to play Jesus in a major motion picture. And I'm trying to remember the name of the film, but it was directed by Kevin Reynolds, who did like Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and it's a religious film.
It's the
Waterworld.
No, it's the fucking one where they go back in time to try and kill Jesus. Vice.
No, it's not that. Is it not that one?
Oh, I thought it was.
Hang on. Let me look. This is going to be worth looking up.
Well, you look it up. I do want to ask one question because of your Australian basis. Like, we were talking about linguistics at the beginning of this pod. The actual language they decided to go with the Sully kids and with the locals sounds very like New Zealand, like Australian surfer bro. Is that's my outsider perspective? Like, they literally say bro all the time. They're like, come on, bro. Like, he talks to a whale. Loak talks to a whale and he calls him bro. If you can't love this movie, I just don't understand. He's like, oh, come on, talk to me, bro. I know it's okay, bro. I love it.
Okay. So the movie is called, and yeah, you're right. They're just doing a Maori bro thing. It's fantastic. So the movie's called Risen.
Yeah.
And Joseph Fiennes plays like a Roman soldier in Palestine, and he gets pulled up by Pontius Pilate and says, oh, look, we executed this Jewish rabble rouser the other day, and the body's gone missing. Can you go and track it down? Otherwise, they're going to think this guy's the Messiah. Like, we're going to have an uprising on our hands. So it's a procedural mystery, like, who stole the body? And of course, it's Jesus,
Wow. He's risen from the grave, and Cliff Curtis plays Jesus. And wow. It's kind of, for these religious films, this is actually kind of a cool one. Like, up until it starts getting real kind of God-bothery, I was having a good time with it, you know, because Kevin Reynolds knows how to point a camera.
It's got, yeah, it's got good cuts. Yeah, yeah, it's directed by Kevin Reynolds. It's got Joseph Fiennes, Tom Felton, Peter Firth, Cliff Curtis. Like, I remember when this movie came out, but I've never seen it. But now I feel like I need to watch this shit. I feel
like track it down. Like, it's not going to change your life or anything. But Cliff Curtis is Mary Jesus.
My life is on a slow downward spiral every day, so nothing ever changes it. I just want moments that kill the pain. So as long as I got that, I'm good.
But speaking of pain, my final observation is that it is insane that James Cameron got everyone to learn how to free dive to make this fucking movie. Like, he didn't have them like scuba diving, which is difficult enough, but you know, you can get your head around it. But free diving is, it's scuba diving without the tanks, man. Like, you know, we've heard the story about how, what, Kate Winslet held her breath for like 7 minutes. Like, that is doable. Like, that is absolutely doable. But like, I don't fuck with free diving. I like breathing too much. The idea that all these actors, and you know, like Sigourney Weaver learned how to free dive and all, that's like, it's insane. Like, and how do you get that commitment out of your cast? Like, how much would you have to fucking love James Cameron to go, all right, I'm gonna learn how to not drown for you, James? Because you know, it's difficult. Like, not being able to breathe underwater is incredibly stressful. When you learn to dive, it's basically a head game, and you have to learn how to push through the psychological barrier of being underwater for an extended period of time. It is not natural. It is weird. It takes practice. So the fact that, like, pretty much this entire cast learned not just how to scuba dive but how to free dive is incredible to me. Like, that's an achievement. Like, that's insane.
Well, how much do you have to like James Cameron, or in Kate Winslet's case, how much do you have to hate James Cameron? Because
she made another water movie with him.
Yeah, she's given interviews, you know, and back when Titanic came out, that it was very difficult and she hated it. And so when he asked her to come back for this one, she was pretty much like, fuck you, I am going to do this better. And literally like, and as somebody who, I am at my best work, regardless of professionally or personally, when I'm doing it out of spite, I have nothing but just chef's kiss for Kate Winslet on that. If I am doing something out of spite, I will walk through hell just so that I can get out of the end of hell and be like, go fuck yourself. And so I do love that. But again, the thing for me on that is, that's amazing. He's still inspiring. Whether he's inspiring because he's a dick, he's still inspiring, right? He's still... Kate Winslet has worked with a lot of directors. She doesn't need to come back and work with James Cameron. So there's something about him that makes her be like, no, I need to show this motherfucker that I can hold my breath longer than fucking Tom Cruise did in Rogue Nation, you know? And I mean, not to support toxic masculinity, because I don't think that is what Cameron is. But what I do think is he's the fucking, if you've ever seen, as a lawyer, if you've ever seen The Paper Chase, John Houseman in that movie, just dick professor, but also inspires everybody, you know, because he's a dick, because he understands like the power of fuck you is as powerful as any type of motivation out there. So I think that's kind of one of the amazing things about this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's not much to follow up with that. It's just like,
And again, I'm the guy who hasn't seen the fucking movie, but I have read all the interviews, and I feel like, I mean, all you guys have done, even Travis with your quibbles, all you've done is sell me on, I need to watch this fucking movie. Like, I have zero doubt. As soon as I don't have to fucking quarantine anymore, I'm going to go see this fucking thing. And I have all the faith in the world, unlike some of the other movies we've talked about, Thor, Love and Thunder, that I'm going to fucking love this thing. Like, let's move on so that we're not here for like 7 hours. Hey, friend of the show, friend of Liam, friend of all of us, Timo Giajanto, just dropped a new movie on Netflix this week called The Big Four. And since I couldn't go to Avatar, I immediately spun up the big four, and I literally, my letterbox review of the movie is this: fucking Timo just does not miss. There's really no other review I can give of the movie than fucking Timo just does not miss. This is completely different from anything else he's done before, and yet it still feels so wholly and uniquely Timo. It is an action comedy. It's a buddy, kind of a buddy, I don't want to say buddy cop movie, but like, because there's no cops, but it's a that formula. But yet everybody that dies in the most horrifically grotesque, violent manner possible. He fucking knocked this one out of the park. He, for me at least, he just absolutely slayed this one. Travis, did you get a chance to watch The Big Four?
Yeah, man, I watched it on Friday and I loved it. And you're right, like, it is completely different to everything else he's made, and yet his authorial voice is just clear as a bell. Like, it is such a Timo film, and it's kind of a bit of a Hong Kong throwback. Like, it's got that great sort of tonal shifts in terms of, you know, like slapstick comedy and then action and then like really fucking grotesque gore gags and shit. Yeah, like, I had a blast with it. Like, I really, really dug it.
Feist, did you get it? Because you were going to watch it today. Did you watch it?
Yeah, I did. It's great. Yeah. I guess I had to get used for the first like 20 minutes. I had to remodulate my brain to, oh, wait, this is comedy. Like, because I was prepared for like this. I mean, I knew he said like this is comedy for families, quote unquote. So, but you know, it's still like a murder, like gratuitous murder going on. But like, I had to just like realize, oh no, wait, he's actually going for the comedy all the way. So like a half step. So once I realized, this is a blast. Like, you know, like you mentioned, like all these like I think you mentioned in your image board like the big hit, all these old like you know like what's the one with Van Damme and Ralph Snyder? What that called again? Knock off. Like all those 90s era like weird Hong Kong crossovers that were just like ridiculous, you know. Even a bit of Drive and some of it, you know, like those, that kind of vibe of like we're going all the way with the action, but also all the way with the comedy too. Yeah, it's just perfectly of a part of those. And also just like after seeing, how do I say this? Like when you watch international films in general, you kind of get the flavor of the pacing and timing because of the way the language works. Like once you're familiar with like how language sounds, like for example, if you watch a Yakuza movie from Japan, you kind of understand how Yakuza guys sound, like the way they roll the R's, like they hype themselves up. So like you're used to the beats of how they talk, so it gets you in the zone. Like not unlike when you hear a gangster movie, you know, you hear the Italian stereotypes, or you watch a black gangster movie, like there's a very similar thing you can get attuned to. So with this Indonesian film, I'm getting more attuned to like the ebb and flow of the language. So it's like I'm catching on with the comedy beats, because Timo mentioned in Twitter that there's some jokes that don't translate directly because just the way the idioms of language work. But like once you get the flow of how they're talking, like in the very beginning, the first scene where you see a little kid and what you realize an operative, they're in like this organ stealing joint, fake hospital. And he's telling the kid, be brave, but you know, be brave, you know, be a tough guy. And then the goon comes in, and he's like, no, really, no, not me. Like, once you get used to that, once you follow how their peaks and valleys of how they speak, it becomes so much clearer, and the comedy hits so much better. So even though the actual language syntax of the jokes may not always be the same thing, just the flow of the comedy, which is going back to the flow of the action, like. I'm very familiar with Timo's action flow, so then to see it works well with this comedy, with these great actors, and they're doing all these great comedy beats within the action itself, you know, just like, you know, back Jackie Chan or Van Damme used to do, like, it works so well. So yeah, it's just really enjoyable, like that kind of, like I said, a throwback, but it's still, you know, of his time, using modern, you know, modern Indonesian action, Timo-style action. It's great.
Well, yeah, and I love that you brought up, because I brought up this too, that the whole, like, this feels like, as you know, I am a massively diehard fan of my beloved golden era of Hong Kong. And one of the things I love about them is the wild tonal shifts. And this has those. This is just flipping from tone to tone to tone to all the, you know, just absolutely, it feels like a Hong Kong movie to me. Because one of the things, there's a lot of movies that have tried to capture that Hong Kong vibe recently, and where they fail is they fail in the action. And you know who doesn't fail in action? Timo. Timo has never failed in action. Timo has never missed a beat in action. Timo has never not been one of the best action directors in the world. And again, we're biased. He's a friend of ours. We love him, but he's a friend of ours because we love him. I came to Timo as a fan, and then we got him on the show and talked to him. Like, it wasn't like this thing where he's like my friend and I'm like trying to like, but this is so different from what he's done, but still so Timo that I fucking loved it. I was bouncing off the walls when I watched this fucking thing. This was, I honestly did not think I would see a quote unquote, I guess, low budget action movie that I liked this year better than Accident Man 2. And I'm going to actually have to watch both The Big Four and Accident Man 2 again, because I'm really not sure. Like, The Big Four is that fucking good.
I've actually watched it twice so far. So I watched it on Friday so I could review it on my radio slot. And then Saturday night, my buddy Tim, who will probably be listening to this, so hi, Tim, shout out. His wife was off at a gig. She went to a concert. So we got some bro tone. So we got, yeah, food and quite a bit of weed and got high as balls and watched The Big Four. And it works just as good the second time around. But, and this is going to appall a lot of people, the first time I watched it, to replicate the experience of getting like an unknown Hong Kong action comedy out of the video store, I watched it with the English dub. And it worked a treat. I felt like I was fucking 18 again. It was brilliant. I recommend it. I know purists are going to arc up at that and say that's
no,
the
but
way
I love
to
it. It's the kind of movie that should have a shitty dub. Yeah. But it's the kind of, it totally feels like it's the kind of movie, you know, it's got that Shaw Brothers vibe. It's got that Harvest vibe. I do want to shout out, and Liam, I actually don't know if you know this actor or not. But Ambanana Ariasatea, who's the main lead, he's in The Night Comes for Us, and he's also in, why am I drawing a blank on the first BCU movie? Liam, help me out on this one.
Gundala.
He's the lead in Gundala. We really, like, action folks really need to start fucking talking about him as one of the best in the biz, because he is so amazing in this. And that's now three movies of his in a row that he's just killed it in.
I was just going to say real quick, I've only saw the first 40 minutes because I'm still jet lagged and I can't put anything that violent on until the children are asleep. And then when you're tired and everything, like the dub, I actually might try the dub now that you mentioned that, because I'll probably be a little easier on my eyes. But what I loved when you mentioned the cast, Mike, is that like it's Timo really branching out into a bunch of different local talent. And everybody is more than game. I think the photography looks fantastic. The humor, I'm completely, it was exactly what I was expecting when he told me. I worked with a bunch of different Indonesian writers on different projects over the years. So I've watched a bunch of the different local, from different genres, you know, where this is a writer, but she usually does romantic comedy. So I'd watch a romantic comedy. So I kind of was pretty much 100% expecting what it was, but I got to say, like, you know, as much as I've always loved his movies, like this one feels the most like my type of movie. I really enjoy this flavor. I really like, because he's not fucking totally, you know, holding back on the gore. Like in the opening, you know, there's a bunch of headshots in a row
not holding back on the gore at all.
Stabbing people up through the throat, but it's just the intention of it. And like, maybe the shot doesn't linger quite as long and try to make you feel awful about it. It's a lighter, more fun version of it. So I'm really enjoying it, and it's like a kind of exactly what I actually think from, like, it's exactly the right movie that he should have made at this point. I feel like it's a great step for him, and like you said, it kind of feels like an 87 North movie, but you know, I like the action better than a lot of their movies, so like maybe that will lead to a you know, a collaboration down the line.
You say he's holding back on the gore, but the first headshot where like a quarter of the guy's fucking head just that pushed me back in my seat a bit.
Yeah, the sniper is great. Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing that I love about it is it's like this weird combination of like Shaolin soccer and I don't know, like fucking A Better Tomorrow. Like it's just, this is just so, there's so many influences here, and Timo's wearing them on his sleeve. And I love to also, like you said, Liam, he's branching out with using more local talent, because there's definitely some characters like the, you know, we're not trying to spoil too much, but you know, one of the main characters is a cop who as I'm watching her, I'm like, that totally should be Chelsea Islan. But it's not. And I like that. I like that Timo's branching out, because obviously there's more than five good actors in Indonesia.
Right.
And so I love that he's branching out. And even though maybe he's using some of these archetypes that he's used before, he's casting them with different actors. And I think that's great, because I think the chemistry amongst the actors in this is so fucking good. And the villain, and I'm drawing a blank on his name, but he is doing a Simon, for those like Hong Kong fans listening, he is fucking Simon Yam from Full Contact. Like, he is doing like one of the most like flamboyant, evil, amazing villain performances, and I fucking love it. Like, I really, as much as you guys loved Avatar, which I'm sure I will, that's how much I love The Big Four. Like, this is legit, like, giving my favorite movies of the year a run for the money. And I don't want to oversell it, but this movie was literally made. It's like Timo said, there's this fucking pasty ass white dude in Utah who I've talked to a couple of times, and I'm going to make a fucking movie for him and him alone. And that's literally what he did with this one, because I fucking loved this movie. I was just giddy watching this one.
The villain plus his badass lieutenant henchwoman. Oh man, I just reminds me of, because we're talking about recent films that are like action comedies. It kind of reminded me of I think it was been 2 years ago now. It was a Korean movie called Extreme Job, and it was so funny because it was basically about these loser detectives who go undercover in a fried chicken joint, but yeah, they're so good at selling fried chicken that they become entrepreneurs instead of being cops. But like, yeah, it has a similar like similar device where it's like it's an action comedy, but you don't realize, but the actual action comes at the end part. It's not really the parent, it's actually the action comedy. But yeah, just an ensemble, like four main characters, the flamboyant villain with a tool henchman. Yeah, like this is, and it's just that like we're saying, you know, like well, I was gonna to go back to Avatar real quick. We just saw Wakanda Forever. They had also an extended underworld sequences, and you know, Avatar was like, no, this is how you do it to me. But then beyond that, they're like, you know, it's for real. But like, I think that for everybody who's still, for all the kind of people who are still in dread about the state of cinema, or whatever, like, you know, how the big blockbusters aren't delivering for you in one way or the other. Like, again, the point of the show, like to share these great experiences. You like, you know, the Big Fours, and these are all like readily available to you. You know, if you're, you know, most of the state Netflix, whatever, like this is the stuff, this is the good stuff that cinema has to offer. Like, don't like the fact that this came out in the same weekend as Avatar, I think is not a, it's like destined, it's aligned. Like, it's not one versus the other. It's like, this is the totality of cinema is these two movies this weekend. Like, I'm serious. Like, this is like, if you like movies, it's all here for you. Just gotta,
you're
like
fucking feasting this weekend, man.
Yeah,
you're just,
it's all here.
Well, it's really action too. It's like act and low budget action, and it's actually some of the stuff that I would say to the producers in the production meetings I had last week, when I was like, what can you do in this space? Like, you can't compete with these blockbusters like that, but you can do things that they can't do. They can't be R-rated. You know, they can't blow people's brains out. They can't show it the way you can show it and the way you can stage it. And they don't really have time to even do that choreographed fight within a single hallway or a single room. The Marvel movies and all, they continually have told us they have no interest in doing that. And so we know that there's this other fan base of people that really want that, and they really want that kind of tactile, tangible action between human beings. And so that is sort of like, I always try to think about that, and I think when I see Timo doing it, it's exactly that sort of that same process. He's like, what can I bring that other people aren't doing, and really do it to the fullest. And so, yeah, it's fucking great.
Yeah, I agree. And I actually blame you guys. Cause like I've always been I'll explain in a second. I've always been an action fan because like I'm a dude. And I've also, you know, I'm a very serious professional critic, and I spread a wide net and I watch all kinds of stuff and blah, blah, blah. But particularly since I started listening to this podcast and kind of hanging out with you guys on Twitter, I've kind of become evangelical about the notion that the most interesting and creative work being done in cinema right now is in the straight to streaming or limited release, low budget action space. Like, this is where all the good shit is happening. And you guys have like helped me to that realization. Okay. So thank you. Thank you very much. But yeah, I'm fucking action Twitter ride or die now. Like, it's just the best movies are being made in this space. It's as simple as that. I love it.
It's so great what you talked about being honest about like who you are. Cause I felt like I used to, you know, a lot of social media is like, you know, there's the performative aspect of like, who am I? And I want everyone to know I'm like a well-rounded person who likes all type of things. But I feel like I've let that fall away since I've done this podcast. I'm like, I really just really like this part of the thing. And I don't have to, I'm not a film critic. I'm not, I don't have to put out a best of the list. I don't have to say these are the movies that made me. I don't have to do all that shit because I make my own movies. So you can look at the movies and you know the answer to all of that fucking prompt stuff. So it's like, I it feels great that I don't have to put out like some top 10 and be like, carefully considered so you think I'm a well-rounded great person. I'm like, I don't care anymore. I'm a fucking meathead and I like to make fucking top tank cinema. Tank top cinema. So it's like I just love that freedom of this podcast. I feel like has allowed me to just kind of self-actualize in some ways.
You got to clip that video of it just now. Like, I don't care what the other movies can make him. Like, what a fucking mic drop. I said before on Twitter like that Liam is like, he's like the new metal Truffaut. Like, you know how like he's like being a critic, they're like, or well, yeah, you do it. Then he did. He made 400 blows. He's like, yeah, fuck you. This is what Liam does, but he makes like actual 400 blows of fighting.
That was actually, and I'm not gonna call the person out, but there was somebody that responded to Timo that I saw on Twitter. I DM'd you, Liam. I DM'd you, and I'm not gonna call the guy out because I'm not interested in a dog pile. But it's like, you're really gonna fucking tell Timo how to make like an action scene, like fucking Timo. Like, it's like, it's the same thing with you, Liam. It's like, oh, I'm sorry. Do you have Blu-rays on your shelf? No, fuck you. And like, you know, and I get that. Like, there are shitty filmmakers, but there is definitely a point of like, I want
to
make.
I just have to. You said it, so I just have to show.
But there are, I mean, don't forget, I have fucking Portals on my shelf. So.
Yeah, it's true. They can't all be winners.
You didn't pull Portals out, I noticed.
I actually, let's just make it the two. But yeah.
No, but that's my point is it's like, look, it's like, yeah, we do. And this is actually a great segue for me to, because I think it's pretty clear we all really love the Big Four. This is actually a great segue for me to go into As Good As Dead, because I think I'm the only one that saw it. This is another perfect example. Like, look, As Good As Dead, I'm not kidding you, had to be made for $1.50, a six pack and a large pizza. I mean, it is so unbelievably cheap. I can't even describe it. But you know what it does have? Michael Jai White. And while normally I like my action heroes to be a little vulnerable in their movies, I like them to take a beating and then come back. There is no sweeter joyous, glorious feeling in cinema than watching Michael Jai White just lay waste to some fucking fools. Like, and so for those who don't know the plot is he's basically this guy that's living out in the middle of the desert in Mexico. And this kid, it's this weird combination of like Cobra Kai and like John Wick. This kid who's getting bullied at school sees Michael Jai White training every day. And so then Michael Jai White essentially invites him in and starts training him. And then you find out that Michael Jai White is like an ex-DEA agent who put Tom Berenger in prison, and they've been trying to find him. And the way they find him is because the kid he's training. So Michael Jai White has this very specific fighting style where he like, you're not going to see this in the audio, but like, it's based on this. So he's constantly like covering
the Kisei method.
But without the elbows, it's the blocking, but it's not the elbows of the Kisei. It's almost more like Vice. What's the, I ask you this.
Blocks.
Yeah. It's almost like 52 blocks is what he's doing. And so this kid, the kid that he's training, ends up getting in this underground cage fight that goes on YouTube. And Tom Berenger and the other bad guys recognize it because he's using the like 52 blocks fighting style. And so they're able to track Michael Jai White down. Okay, look, I'm sorry. That plot might as well be fucking liquid crack to Mikey. Like, you might as well just inject that shit into my vein.
Something like a coke dream. This kid is in YouTube underground fighting. He's learning the Kisei method. The goons. What?
And so to me, it's like, yes, it doesn't totally succeed. And in fact, when we get to the climax, if the biggest complaint I have with the movie is the third act is a bit of a letdown, because that was really clear where the like lack of budget came in. But Michael Jai White doing this unique fighting style, the kid whose name is Lucas Oriel, fucking cast that kid in Cobra Kai. Like, he's like it's like his announcement as an action star. So to me, this is the kind of movie that's like, when I say it's what I mean when it's the best of DTV, it's not Day of Reckoning. It's not Undisputed 3. It's not, you know, it's not at that level where it exceeds it. But what it is like 89 minutes and a lot of fucking fun. And Michael Jai White just laying waste to fools. And I'm sorry, I am a simple man. I have no needs more than 89 minutes of Michael Jai White laying waste to fools. So yeah, As Good As Dead is available on streaming. You can rent it as of Friday. I gotta recommend it. I don't think everybody's gonna love it. It's not The Big Four good. It's certainly not Avatar good, but as an Action for Everyone, you know, podcast, it's the kind of movie that we've promised we'd talk about. And I think it's worth watching.
So I looked up this guy, Luca Oriel, this kid. Oh, he has such a great soft boy face. It's perfect. Yeah, he's got to be a Cobra Kai. He looks like a little baby.
He literally is like an older, a little older and like taller version of Sholo Martin Ueda.
Yeah.
Like that's literally, as I'm watching him, that was all I could think of. But yeah, he's so good in it.
Good for soft boys, that's good.
Yeah, and it's also got our boy, it's got Liam's boy, our boy, the patron saint of A4E, Louis Mandalore, in it, doing what he always does, which is being better than any fucking material that he's given. I enjoyed it. I recommend it. Travis, I don't even know if it's available in Australia yet, because I know
not on my radar at all, man, but I will check it out based on your recommendation.
Yeah,
I did see another action movie this week, which I'd forgotten about because technically I'm embargoed. So this does not constitute a review, lawyers. But I saw, and I always forget the title because it's a dumb title, Operation Fortune Ruse de Guerre.
Oh shit. Is that
new
actually
Guy Ritchie?
Is that actually like available now? Like, is
now
that
they just out? They did a press screening and there was like me and one other dude there. And they here's the thing. They
They announced the screening really late. Like, I had 2 days warning. It was a 10 a.m. screening in a tiny cinema. One other guy showed up, and I am embargoed until the new year. But I think you can read between the lines and gauge the
a winner through and through. top of the list. 2023 coming at you.
Absolutely. Yeah. My number one film of 2023.
All right. Well, that's good to know.
It's the Top Gun Maverick of 2023.
Travis, RIP your mentions. All right. Liam's got to wrap up because he's actually going to a Joey McIntyre concert tonight.
Yeah. I'm going to wear this too. I'm just going to show up and be like, this guy's certifiably insane. No, I'm not ballsy enough to wear the Action for Everyone tank top. Although I did wear this in gyms across the world. So I was repping across the world, everybody.
Oh, yeah. I am so fucking jealous that you're going to a, yeah, again, I said this, we were DMing and I said, you know what? I need to move to LA so that you and Kelsey, who's also a meathead, can work out and Pet and I can go to like fucking Joey McIntyre and then KOTB and BSB concert.
Perfect.
Cause our hobbies do like our hobbies are crossed, but
yes.
Travis, where can people find you if they're looking for you on social media?
Oh, I'm all over the place. I'm hanging out on Twitter as Celluloid Whiskey. I'm going to rebrand soon. I'm a little worried that this whole kind of, you know, half in the bag, kind of critical drinker, sort of, you know, booze hound film critic space is occupied by, well, a bunch of assholes, really. I don't want to be associated with them. So I'm going to figure out a rebrand. So, but cool. For the moment, I'm Celluloid Whiskey. And I'm on Instagram, I think, under the same nick. And you know, I'm on Facebook because, like, Twitter's fucking going insane. And I'm like, how do I connect with people now that the second richest man in the world has gone completely mental?
Insane today. Yeah, so I'm around. Yeah. God forbid you have a link tree.
But I've just decided I'm going to embark on a new project. I'm going to write an action movie remake of 400 Blows for Liam to direct. We're going to call it 400 Body Blows. So I'll start cracking on that.
Excellent.
Vice Victus, where can people find you?
I am on Twitter at Vice Victus for the time being. I'm here to the end, baby, to the wheels fall off. I'm there talking shit. I'm on Letterboxd, being smart at the same name. So I'll put my review of The Big Four and Avatar up there pretty soon. And I'm on Instagram as well, if it's just looking hot as always.
Liam O'Donnell, where can people find you?
Stirring Shit on Twitter, Liam Odin, Instagram, a Space Marine in the streets and a Navi in the sheets. I'll see you guys later.
You've been like waiting for that all day. You've been
sitting on that for 2 hours, haven't you?
You literally just have been sitting on
that. I came ready today. I came prepped.
Came ready. You can find me at the time being on Twitter at Hibachi Justice and basically any social media if you want to find me. I'm Hibachi Justice. A4E is everywhere. The easiest way to find us is just go to linktree.com/A4E podcast because we can't post that on our Twitter anymore.
Time to be alive.
Yeah, what a fucking time to be alive. But anyway, we're on Reddit, we're on Hive, we're on Mastodon, we're on YouTube, we're on everywhere. So you're not going to lack the ability to find us. And obviously you're listening to us, so you know you can find the show anywhere podcasts can be downloaded. Boys, Travis, first of all, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And I know you had to get up probably earlier today than you wanted to make the time work.
You got the time wrong, motherfucker. You said 8 a.m. and it was 9 my time.
I did not. I said 3 p.m. my time. I got fucked by the fucking time change. So, yes, I apologize.
No, it's all good, man. It's all good. And thanks for having me. It's been fantastic. I've been champing at the bit, hoping to wangle a guest spot on Action for Everyone for like 6 months now. So this is it's a bit of a dream come true. Very happy. And I'm glad we've had this this moment of Australian-American cultural exchange. And we've taken the edge off the C-bomb. I think we're all going to be a lot more comfortable dropping that one on social media now. Because you are all honorary Australians now. It's not just Vice, it's all of you.
Well, real quick, when I was in the undisclosed location, we had Australian soldiers with us, and I did the Tim Tam Slam.
Oh, the Tim Tam Slam, yes.
Yeah, so this is if you see on the chocolate here in your coffee, buddy. thank you for coming. We appreciate you.
Hold on. So just for people listening, we lost Liam because he's got to go to Joey McIntyre. But I know we're going to wrap this up really quick, but I need to know, because I love Tim Tams. So I need to know what a Tim Tam Slam is.
Oh, well, as it was told to me, is it's like a not hollow, but there's space within the cookie. It's like a miniature, how do I explain it to American? It's like a miniature Twix kind of little bit.
I love Tim Tams. I literally buy Tim Tams in my pantry right now. So
you bite it in half so we can like become like a straw. So you put the Tim Tams in the coffee. Well, that's how they told it to me. You put it in the coffee.
They lied to you. They were fooling you. the pro way, how you doing? Is you bite off the opposite corners to get the full sort of flow, and you dip you bite off one corner and then the other corner, and you like use it like a straw, and you suck your coffee or your hot chocolate through the Tim Tam, and it gets all chocolicated. You just get the chocolate flavor coming, and then it disintegrates because it's a fucking biscuit. But yeah, that's the Tim Tam Slam. That's extremely Australian.
Can I do that with like whiskey or Kahlua?
Sure, why not? I mean, I wouldn't do whiskey, but I think
Kahlua or a Bailey's or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, okay, I'm gonna fucking I get this store just down the street from me sells Tim Tams, so I gotta go get some more fucking Tim Tams and try this. This has been the most educational Action for Everyone for me yet. So
we are gonna make visual confirmation on this. I want a photo or a video on Twitter.
I will do that. Absolutely. So,
and when celebs come to Australia, like when they're doing the convention circuit, like old Star Trek actors and shit, like we force them to do the Tim Tam Slam. It's just like, it's a big thing. It's like, you got to fucking do this. You're in Australia now. Don Barrowman's like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Love it. All right, boys, let's do this again. Travis, we will definitely get you on again. This is not going to be a one-time appearance for you. Vice, we'll do this again next week. For those listening, I am going to pick a winner for our Hi-Ya giveaway. Once again, thank you, Hi-Ya, for sponsoring us for Global Martial Arts Day. And next week, I think we're going to do it'll probably just be me, Vice, and Liam, and we're going to do like our 10 best action movies of the year. So be on the lookout for that. So love you, boys. We'll talk soon.
All right, take care.
See you soon, brother.